one of the first things that comes up is everybody's limiting constraint to how many, whether they can buy their first dealership or their millions, is how much capital do you have available to you, right? It is the number one limiting constraint. Almost everybody we talk to has the skills, the experience, the expertise. They're willing to move. They have experience with a variety of brands. Their number one limiting constraint is how much equity capital do you have?
You're listening to Driving Performance, your go-to podcast for unmatched expertise in the world of buying and selling an automotive dealership. Each episode features discussions with industry leaders and is brought to you by Performance Brokerage Services, North America's premier family-owned automotive dealership brokerage firm with over 30 years of experience. We're here to ensure you gain the most reliable insights to confidently navigate a transaction and accomplish your unique goals. Whether you're looking to buy or sell, we prioritize building lasting relationships and maximizing the value beyond the transaction level. Here are your hosts, Jamie Farley and Paul Keckney, for another segment of Shifting Gears.
Welcome to Driving Performance. Today we have two fantastic guests from Live Oak Bank who are experts in dealership financing. Jason Lumpkin, Senior Vice President, Auto Dealerships, and Connor Duncan, Vice President of Dealerships, are here to discuss everything from SBA loans, the current challenges in floor plan lending, and what to expect if you're seeking financing for an acquisition.
Yes, they offer financial solutions for a specific segment in the automotive industry. Jason, Connor, welcome to the show.
Paul, Jamie, thank you very much for having both of us. I really appreciate the opportunity. We're excited to talk about the state of lending with you both.
We are excited for that. So Jason and Connor, thank you again for being here. Let's start by having each of you explain your role at Live Oak Bank and the types of clients you serve in the dealership space.
Absolutely. Maybe I can start. Connor, you clean me up. My name is Jason Lumpkin. Been with the bank since 2011. We started the bank back in 2008, really under the premise that M&A financing for small business owners has been really neglected by the banking market, in part because of the way all of us banks are organized is both retail businesses and the way we're regulated by our partners at the FDIC, and had this challenge that we set out to say, can we not provide acquisition financing to small business owners across the country more efficiently with better rates, terms, and leverage than available through most of the local banks in that community? Fast forward to today, we are the nation's largest SBA lender. It's a program, a government guaranteed lending program that's been around since the 1950s. It's about a $30 billion program annually. Over 1,600 participant banks in said program. And we are by far the largest in the country, in part because it's all we do, focusing on using that government guaranteed lending program to help business owners buy a business. So we've got about 1,000 folks. All of us, like Connor and myself, are for the most part actively engaged in finding those business owners and hearing about their problems and trying to help them put together financing solutions. We don't have a ton of staff here focused on retail or consumer banking. Again, all day, every day, we're trying to find that small business owner that's ready to take the lead. So I run our dealer services platform here. We've done roughly $350 million worth of funded loans to franchise dealers. To put that in perspective, we have a portfolio of about $10 billion of loans out today to small business owners. We predominantly use these government guaranteed financing products, which we'll talk about in a little bit, but you know, we're engaged actively with the OEMs, the centers of influence, Performance Brokerage being probably our favorite partner in the industry, and trying to get closer to, you know, again, that business owner that, you know, maybe I've been a GM for 15, 20 years. I've learned all the skills necessary to be an owner, and they need that partner to invest in them, give them a little bit extra help to buy their first store, their second or third for that matter. So Connor, maybe I can hand it off to you.
Yeah. Connor Duncan. I've been at the bank since 2015. Spent some time in our servicing department. Once a loan funds, one of the unique things about the bank is there's one individual that services that account on a quarterly basis and sort of maintains that rapport by and between bank and customer. Did that for a period of time until I joined underwriting. And about 4.5 years ago, which is when Jason had identified Franchise Automotive as being the next new vertical to lend to, I became the underwriter for every automotive transaction until the velocity of deals we were getting necessitated another lender on the sales side, which is the role I have today, and partnered with Jason in that. It's been really fun and challenging business to be a part of. Obviously, when we got into the business not too long after was COVID. Last year, you've got a strike and everything in between. It's been fun and challenging to be a part of all that. But when the result is helping talented, aspiring dealers accomplish career and lifelong dreams of becoming dealers, Jason and I get a lot of joy out of that. So thanks again for having us.
Thanks for being here. So let's dive into some questions. What are you seeing? What's the current, if you want to call it, state of SBA loans? And what are you finding that dealers find attractive in using an SBA loan?
I'll start from like sort of a high level. Objectively, we provide a financing solution that no one else does, right? Which is naturally more attractive to folks that are looking to buy a store, especially considering how expensive dealerships have gotten today. We'll get into more detail as the conversation goes on, but I think our primary benefits of the financing is term and leverage. Jason alluded to it earlier in the conversation, but you know, historically in the industry, if you can get acquisition financing, you know, it's on a five-year term at 50% leverage, whereas the SBA product that we provide is 10-year financing at a minimum. Depending on real estate and some other factors, you have the ability to go up to even 25 years, which really helps from a cash flow standpoint. And oh, by the way, we can finance more leverage, right? Instead of 50%, we can go up to 90% when it makes sense. Subjectively, so much of our business development has been centered upon education. Folks like yourselves, the OEMs, the floor plan lenders, sort of letting them know that the SBA product is alive and well. It goes widely unused in the franchise automotive space. And therefore, the education piece is critical to getting the word out that it's alive and that it actually works. That's sort of been the main thing that we focused on. And again, we speak with dealers at every stage across the acquisition spectrum. We get involved really early in the process, and we get involved with folks that have a deal under contract and are ready to execute on that. So I think what we've tried to do is, regardless of where they are in that process, we try to add value from our experiences to help them be better prepared to execute.
I'm going to just jump in with a second question that, Jason, maybe you can touch on. But Connor was just saying you can finance up to 90%, but we know the OEMs typically only allow 50%. How do you manage through that process? Can you explain that for our listeners?
Absolutely. So if I can take a step back for a moment, you know, if I'm a buyer listening to this podcast, you have to remember that the banking institutions out there all answer to somebody, right? We're all regulated by the FDIC or the Fed. And when we offer products and services to our customers, and you pick up the telephone and you call most banks, they're going to give you a very similar answer because of the way that we're regulated. In the world of banking, most things seem black or white. And again, it's because the folks that we all objectively answer to require that if you're going to provide a loan to acquire a business, it must include some sort of secondary source of repayment. So while we all believe that the dealer is going to be capable of repaying this loan that they got to purchase this business from the cash flow of the business, no bank is able to make that loan if not having something to back up that source of repayment should something go bump in the night. What we're usually talking about is real estate, right? The beauty of the SBA product, it was created in the 1950s, is that regulators took a step back and said, wow, we've created this wonderful community of small business owners across the country that have built these wonderfully valuable companies that are ready to perpetuate their companies, yet that we have these banking regulations that none of these buyers are going to be able to purchase these stores because they don't have millions of dollars of real estate to back up the millions of dollars of blue sky. So rather than changing the banking rules, what Congress said was, why don't we create a government guaranteed lending program that will ensure to banks the loans that they make, substituting for real estate collateral, a government guarantee, so that we can incentivize lending institutions to provide debt to qualified small businesses. So the beauty of the SBA product is when we start talking with a dealer, the conversation centers around, what are your areas of expertise as a dealer? I know that you spent 15 years getting to this point of ready to buy. You've probably been a GSM and a GM, and you probably have metrics and data that point to, you know how to run a store. You've also built up some equity to be able to buy a store, right? You might not have millions of dollars of real estate collateral in the sideline, but guess what? There's a government guaranteed lending product that we have available to you to help you buy that store. when you pick up the phone and call a captive lender or a commercial bank and start talking about blue sky financing, where that conversation immediately starts is usually one-to-one debt to equity, because we as a regulated banking institution are unable to make blue sky loans unless they are at a certain loan to value, 50-50 being the way that we're regulated as a bank, and the term cannot exceed 5 to 7 years. Okay. So going back to the conversation about the state of the SBA lending market, the beauty of the product inherently is that if you're to call us and ask for a conventional loan, we're going to look just like any other captive lender, right? The reason our rates and terms and leverages are so aggressive is because we're using this government guaranteed product to offer more leverage than any other banking institution. Part of the challenge there is that we are not aware of any other bank that is aggressively offering SBA loan solutions to dealers, right? So you have a phone, you call Bank of America, for example. We've done plenty of deals with Bank of America. They are and have been one of the top five SBA lenders for the last 20 years. Their dealer services team does not offer SBA financing to dealers, right? So I think that if I'm a listener of this podcast, the first thing I'm thinking to myself is probably what is SBA, because nobody's talked to me about it, right? And inherently, because the government is going to guarantee the collateral shortfall that you as a buyer are going to have in your deal, 90% leverage is what we're able to offer through the SBA program, something that you're probably not going to hear from any other banking institution. With regard to the state of the SBA market, you mentioned OEMs. The OEMs are laser focused on, do we think that the financing that our dealers are getting is setting them up for success or setting them up for failure? And we as a lender sort of break that into two categories, right? The first one that the factory is going to ask is, can you fill out your S&P forecast balance sheet and show us where you're at one-to-one debt to equity? We are of the belief that if you're at one-to-one debt to equity, it bears no merit on what is your pro forma income statement look like and the store's ability to repay the debt obligation that you've taken on relative to the cash flow of the store, right? So when we say we're willing to go up to 90% leverage, one, the SBA product allows for that. Two, for us, it's centered on if the store can support 90% debt for the right person, our focus isn't on the balance sheet, it's on the income statement.
I think it makes sense. I think I still get a little bit confused over what's going to be acceptable for each OEM. And maybe, Jason, that's more on an individual basis. Like, which OEM is accepting SBA loans as part of the financing and which ones are not? Is there kind of like a clear line on that, or does it maybe get a little fuzzy?
When you think about the SBA program, there are over 1,600 franchise concepts that do business with the SBA annually. The franchise systems throughout this country happen to be probably the biggest borrower under the SBA system than anybody else, okay? The automotive industry happens to be more interested relative to all of the franchise concepts out there on debt to equity than any other franchise brand that we've ever seen. Okay. When we first got into this business, one of the requirements of the SBA program is that the manufacturer actually sign up to be part of the SBA program. When we got into this business, 2M signed up to SBA, Chris and Stan. Fast forward today, all of them are signed up to do business with the SBA and see the value and benefit in the system. The reason I wanted to start with that concept is it is not black and white. It's very gray. We do business with a handful of OEMs that we consistently see willing to bend their internal guidelines on one-to-one debt to equity when it's the right operator, the right store, the right market. They're willing to have a conversation about what is best for our dealer network. Unfortunately, there are other OEMs that the role is more important than the conversation. There happen to be, and I feel like this number for us, Connor, you tell me if you feel differently, is growing every day, but there's plenty of OEMs in the middle that we see willing to have the debate. You know, we don't love bending our one-to-one. We're not going to go 90%, but on the right deal, we'll go 60%, 70%. And I wish I could tell you the formula of what they're thinking about. We can't seem to crack that code. We'd like to think, like us, it's centered around the income statement and the earnings of the store. But if you're asking me to put particular names with brands, I would tell you that we happen to find Nissan Stellantis to probably be two brands that are more willing to have the conversation about, does the story make sense? Kia, Hyundai, Honda, Subaru are brands that I probably put in that middle category. They really want to hold true to the number one, but then when they have that really good operator, maybe they've had 150% MSR, great CSI scores, they've been running a store in brand for the last several years, we've seen them willing to cave. I'd probably say every name that I didn't mention, it has been more strictly to that one-to-one, but it's changing. Just a couple of short months ago, Connor and I would probably tell you that a couple of names in the middle and at least one of the names that's been willing to be flexible weren't, right? So, you know, that's part of the reason we're on the podcast today is, and I'm sure we'll talk about this more a little bit later on, we hope that the OEMs will become more flexible on time with that debt to equity for the right operators, the right stores, and in the right situation.
I would just echo that. I mean, it's definitely a case-by-case basis. I think one of the things that we do in the process with prospective buyers early in the process is say, hey, based on our experiences, here's what we think is doable depending on the brand. And I think one of the things that sticks out to me in terms of those brands that are willing to have that conversation and are a bit more progressive on the debt to equity is we've been able to establish relationships or even identify at the OEM level who's actually making the decision and has the authority to make those decisions. Whereas some of the other brands that are very bureaucratic and are sticking to the one-to-one no matter what, we talk with zone managers and regional folks at the OEM level that are very interested in the SBA product and have identified a handful of talented dealers that they would like to become owners in the network and are willing to have that conversation. Yet when you submit the factor application and go through that whole process, the person that's actually checking the box on the debt to equity has no idea about what went on in the legwork that happened beforehand. And therefore, you know, it doesn't really ring to them as much as it would if you're working with the folks that actually are making that decision. So I know Jason and I try to get in touch and build relationships as much as possible with some of the actual decision makers at the OEM level, because I think they would be interested in it and the interests are aligned. But unfortunately, for the more bureaucratic OEMs, it seems like the folks that are actually making the decisions aren't the ones that are interested in learning more about the SBA product.
Again, my hope is that there's a lot of buyers listening to this podcast today. And when somebody calls us, one of the first things that comes up is everybody's limiting constraint to how many, whether they can buy their first dealership or their millionth, is how much capital do you have available to you, right? It is the number one limiting constraint. Most everybody we talk to has the skills, the experience, the expertise, they're willing to move. They have experience with a variety of brands. Their number one limiting constraint is how much equity capital do you have, right? And if I'm a buyer listening to this podcast, there is in one school of thought, you should certainly buy a brand in which you have the most experience, which will set you up for the most opportunity for success. On the other hand, if you want to create the greatest opportunity for your family and your legacy with the limited amount of equity capital that you have, because everybody's equity capital is limited, doesn't matter if it's $1 or $100 billion, brand has a pretty meaningful impact on how you can leverage your personal equity into the store of the right size and opportunity for your family. If you are an OEM listening to this podcast, and there are OEMs that look at situations and say, I got a store that's been 50% market effective for the last 5 years because I got a seller that's irrelevant. It's a single point market that isn't going to attract a Lithia or an Asbury or a regional. It needs somebody who's going to live there. Their kids are in school there. They're involved in the PTA. Wouldn't it make sense in that circumstance? You've got somebody maybe that wants to buy it that's been 150% market effective in a like-kind store. You want to move metal in this store. Wouldn't you want to maybe take a more subjective approach to approving that buyer than just the one-to-one debt to equity? So again, if you're a buyer listening, know that unfortunately brand makes a meaningful impact on the size store that you can afford to buy. And if you're an OEM that isn't willing to have that debate, maybe you ought to, because you've got really qualified buyers that would love to be in your network that might unfortunately prioritize another network because it's going to allow them to deploy their equity capital more effectively.
So well said. I can't tell you how many times, you know, being in this business for a decade now where a buyer's been turned down for lack of sales effectiveness, lack of ability of funds and some of those things. And talking on funds like you are, there's been some great operators that have been turned down for lack of funds. So I couldn't agree more. When you talk about the OEM, to further that conversation, I can't help but sit there and look at it and go, all right, so they're not getting the 50-50 cash on cash, one-to-one, whatever you want to call it. And let's say it's 70% that we're talking about instead of 50-50. The reality is, in my mind, if I was the OEM, they still have the same amount of working capital. I mean, if they run out, they run out. I guess they could go back into the trough and re-leverage. But from a banking perspective, what would you say to the OEM regarding that? Because I look at it and go, you're still working with the same amount of working capital. To your point, I mean, you've got a balance sheet and you've got a pro forma business plan. Any further thoughts on that?
Yeah, I would just highlight the benefit of the term, right? We've talked a lot about leverage, but the SP product for business acquisition is 10-year financing versus 5. So our whole argument to the OEMs and anybody that's willing to listen for that matter is, let me get this straight. You can borrow half on a 5-year loan term or up to 90% on a 10-year loan term. The impact at the income statement and the cash flow is net pretty close to the same. Yet, yeah. To your point, Paul, now you've required somebody to invest all of their available liquidity into a largely intangible asset that is no longer fungible if not for selling the dealership. Whereas if you borrow a little bit more, 70, 80, 90%, same impact to the cash flow, debt service is the exact same. But now you've got somebody who can either buy a larger store or you've got somebody who can reinvest that money back into the business, especially considering most of the deals we see for sale today are stores that aren't firing on all cylinders. And there's opportunity there, which obviously growth is expensive, right? So the ability to not all of your available capital just to buy the store, but having some cushion and fallback to reinvest into that store to maximize the opportunity is hugely valuable. But that all goes away if you're just stuck on a balance sheet metric rather than looking at it from a holistic approach. So I think the term, in addition to the leverage, is where the SP product really shines and sort of debunks the fact that, hey, you're getting too much leverage.
Great points.
If I could say that differently, if I'm an OEM and I've got a 50% sales effective store that I want to get the right person in there, and I've got an independent operator buying their first store at 90% leverage on a 10-year term, where I've got Lithia buying it on a 1-to-1 debt to equity on a 5-year term, the pro forma income statement is going to look exactly the same with regard to the ability to cover the debt service, right? But how do you feel about Lithia's ability to manage that 200, 300, 400, 500 unit planning volume store 2 hours from a major metro versus that operator that has been a proven commodity for you, hopefully at another store elsewhere buying their first store, but they're actually going to live and breathe in that style of location? You know, they get hung up on the balance because we're not blind to recognize objectively 90% sounds way less safe than 50%, but you need to compare the term and understand you haven't put this person up for failure on the income statement, right? It is exactly the same, but perhaps it's the right person for the opportunity. And conversely, with regard to the balance sheet, just because you've put 50% in, I think most people who own a franchise can tell you that balance sheet equity is not very valuable. It is pretty difficult to go borrow against that 50% blue sky equity on your balance sheet you created. It's a feel-good number.
Really good points.
Yeah, and I heard a couple of things. Thank you for the follow-up description. That made it a lot more clear to me. And I think with you going into detail, that makes it a lot more clear for our listeners too. But a couple takeaways. The positive, it sounds like it's evolving. And you mentioned it's an education piece too, and maybe a little bit of a lack of knowledge. And kind of what I gathered from that is on the dealer end, a lack of knowledge of even what an SBA is and the availability of maybe pursuing this as an option. And then on the OEM side, the education piece of, hey, let's look at it in a different way.
100%.
I mean, when we first got into this business, there's 1,600 franchise companies that do business with the SBA annually. And the vast majority of the dealers were not on the SBA approved list. So, you know, I'm sure many people listening to this podcast have never heard the name Live Oak Bank, which is very common for us, but it is not very common for us to talk to small business owners that have no familiarity with what the SBA program is, and it's not being offered and sold and educated to them. I mean, our first 2 or 3 years in this business was convincing folks that the SBA is a real program. It is a $30 billion program annually that has been part of Congress's budget for 70 years. It's mind-boggling to me that more people have not contemplated it as an opportunity for themselves.
Yes, so true.
So let's switch to the hot topic of floor plan lending. Connor, you were interviewed recently in the Automotive News article regarding the challenge for some buyers to get floor plan financing. You also indicated that a floor plan under $10 million and for certain brands also may be tough to get approved. Can you expand on this a bit?
Yeah, sure. So, I mean, we've been talking a lot about education, right? And talked about the dealers and the OEMs, but the education piece also extends to the floor plan lender, given that's such a vital piece of operating a successful dealership. You know, when I answered that question for Automotive News, I took more of an art, not a science approach. However, I went back to the current portfolio and it really does speak to those numbers. The majority of the dealers in our portfolio have floor plans between $4 and $7 million as a general range, largely because they're single point operators in a non-metro market, right? If we've got 50 dealers in the portfolio today, half of those roughly are first time dealers, right? So these aren't folks that are buying high volume metro market stores, right? I think anecdotally, the $10 million mark comes into play when you are talking about that large, high volume metro market store, or you become a multi-rooftop operator, right? Which again, we don't have a ton of those in the portfolio. Based on our experience and the homework that we've done independently, it does seem that servicing a $10 million line or something less than, or a $30 to $50 million line for conversation purposes, isn't much different, right? So if you're the floor plan lender and have a huge legacy portfolio, while the OEMs continue, some of the OEMs continue to face some of these inventory challenges, the market has seen volatility with earnings greatly normalizing from the highs of COVID. Many of the flooring lenders are taking a back seat and pulling back on some of those smaller deals because in quotes, they're less risky dealer profiles. You know, I think small deals and the smaller floor plan requests can be mitigated when it involves a strong captive. We work with several OEMs that do have strong captive financing programs on the floor plan side, and that certainly helps given their interests are aligned. But even these deals are carrying a lot more scrutiny and requiring increased equity injections that can become too big of a hill to climb. I mean, I can think of a couple deals off the top of my head this year to where the OEM had identified somebody that they wanted the network. We had committed financing to them, and yet the floor plan lender just told them that they couldn't get to a yes, and therefore the deal had fallen apart in the 11th hour. So I think what we're doing to combat against some of this is, you know, again, we speak with folks at every aspect of the spectrum with regards to acquisitions. And so the folks that are early in the process, we're encouraging them, hey, if historically you've been super focused on getting the term debt lined up so you can buy the store, knowing that the OEM and the floor plan are secondary aspects of the acquisition process, that's probably the opposite today. And you need to be spending just as much time with the floor plan lender to make sure that you have a path to a yes before you come to us with term debt. Because the biggest caveat of our financing is, one, is the manufacturer going to be able to approve it? But now, just as important, are you going to be able to get a floor plan for the size and profile of store? So I think that's probably the answer I would give.
I'd like to jump in on that. We had a store in Iowa recently that just closed. The buyer was approved by the manufacturer, turned down by the captive for a floor plan, and turned down by a major bank that we all know that I won't say, but that is in the floor plan lending. And the initial was a turn down from both. And he went back and pleaded his case, got back on the phone, got back on emails, shared more data, you know, more experience, all the things he had to do, and came back with two yeses from the captive and from that bank. Have you seen that? And by the way, small store, less, it was about a $4 million floor plan line. So a small store. But have you seen anyone reverse their decision? Because that was the first for me. I was very pleased to get it, but we ultimately closed. The store is now closed.
I don't think I have. Obviously, it's been done, so the precedent is there. I think where we get hung up the most is in that situation, Paul. Let's say they go back and kind of plead their case. What we've found is that if there is any path to a yes, a big condition has come up that is a CMA offset account. And that provides obviously more collateral and security to the floor plan lender. But if we're talking about an individual that has worked for 10, 20 or 30 years and has now made that decision to go off and do it for themselves, but this is going to be the largest financial investment they make, they probably don't have a $200,000-$500,000 left over to give to the floor plan lender in order to get an approval. So I'm not sure if that had any factor in your situation, but we've had several that even if they could have gotten to a yes, the floor plan lender has come back with, hey, well, how about you park $500,000 here in an offset account and we'll be able to move forward. And they just ultimately don't have that or aren't willing perhaps to have a partner come along the lines because they want to do this by themselves. And I don't know, just I haven't seen that happen, but hopefully because it's been done before, it'll be more common going forwards.
Well, I would tell you from our perspective, we are certainly going to push the envelope if it comes up again.
Absolutely.
Yeah. I mean, I think the takeaway is Connor said it perfectly earlier. It used to be that floor plan financing was an afterthought. If you were able to get term debt financing for the business in real estate prior to 12 to 18 months ago, we would never see a floor plan turned down on a deal that was able to support the term debt that was proposed on top of it. And I think that for those of you that are actively engaged in buying right now, you just need to remember rates have tripled since 2020. The way banks make or don't make money has changed since 2020. So Connor mentioned risk and risk appetite. The other component is reward. And a $7 million line certainly does not generate the same reward, same fixed operating expense, which dealers can understand, as a $20 million line. So I think the takeaway is just, you know, floor plan financing really needs to be front of mind. It can't be an afterthought on your deal. And even if you've got a captive or a bank that's done business with a seller historically, you need to be prepared to shop the floor plan with 4, 5, or 6 different lenders. And to Connor's point on CMA account, I'd answer your question, Paul, a little bit differently. Yes, we have seen buyers be capable of turning a no into a yes at the floor plan lender. The question is, are they willing to meet the floor plan lender's change in structure and requests, whether it's more cash in the deal, whether it's adding a guarantor, cross-collateralizing a store? And the takeaway just being floor plan financing is having more of a disruption on doing deals than we personally have seen in the last 5 years.
Agreed.
So you mentioned because things have changed a little bit, work on getting floor plan first. And then you said, Jason, to shop 4 or 5 different options. So in terms of getting approved, can you maybe give us elaborate on what are they looking for to get approved? And isn't the process of getting a capital loan and maybe seeing that part of the decision making, or are they not kind of, running simultaneously? So maybe just educate us a bit on that.
So I got to frame this. So you got to remember, our business model is centered around helping small to medium-sized dealers utilizing this government guaranteed product, which allows us to be more aggressive. So when we talk about the state of the market, it is not the state of all deals. It is the state of people who own less than 5 rooftops and or are buying their first store. And we're talking about stores sort of in the 300 to 1,000 unit playing volume marketplace, right? It just so happens that same marketplace usually is a seller whom is happy to be underperforming. They might be 50, 60, 70% sales efficient. You get a composite financial statement, gross per copy is off, expenses are off. But you know what? That seller probably is working 5 hours a week. They've been running the store for the same way for an extended period of time. And the buyer who has decided this is the opportunity that works for them is probably doing so because I have a limited amount of equity capital to deploy for my family. I want to buy the biggest opportunity possible. And I have found this store that is underperforming, right? And a lot of the story is about not where the store has been, but where it's going, right? That is something that we continue to do all day, every day. We love projection-based deals. And the beauty of this industry is it's not guessing. You know, there's an abundance of market data available to you. I'm going to take new unit volume from 400 copies a year to 500. You aren't picking those numbers out of the air. The challenge is becoming that when it comes time to sit down and have the debate about your opportunity for that profile of dealer, not your $50 million blue sky deal that, you know, is going to be penciled a certain way. The person that's going to need to tell the story is becoming more challenging to tell because of things of outside of your control, right? Our friends at Stellantis, we love Stellantis. We do a lot of Stellantis deals. You've seen the brand as a whole, their market share go from 12% to 9% to 2.5 years time. No lender, whether it's us, a floor plan lender, great. Seller's 50% sales efficient. You've been sales efficient in all the Chrysler stores you've managed. There's a clear story there, right? Yeah, but what is planning volume for 2025, given the brand's losing market share? Right. What is your run rate and the size of your line going to be moving forward as those variables fluctuate? So unfortunately, people like to think of things in black and white. The lending world, especially in the world of deals in which we live, is very gray. And I think you just need to be prepared to talk about that a lot more. Come to your deal prepared to talk about, you know, what you're going to do to correct any seller deficiencies in their financial statements relative to composites and the operational strategy to get it where it is, but also the headwinds in the marketplace that you can't control. What do we think that Stellantis's top-down changes and their focus on future inventory could have on reduced market share, gained market share? All of those little things that build on each other are leading to a more difficult conversation with the floor plan lenders.
What I would add is you and I and everybody on this call working with dealers have realized these guys and gals are eternal optimists, right? There's no dealer that doesn't think he can do better than what the seller's done, right? And a lot of these folks, to their credit, haven't ever failed, right? They might not have been owners yet, but they've only had success at some of these stores, partially benefiting from some of the craziness going on in COVID and all the increased multiple or gross profits and those sorts of things. But they've always had the ability to outperform, and therefore they think they can do a lot better than the seller. But being able to balance some of that optimism with more realism in the current atmosphere goes a really long way, right? And to Jason's point, being able to root your projections in market data goes a really long way, especially as these floor plan lenders and some of the OEMs continue to pull back, right? I mean, normalization continues to occur more severe with certain brands, as Jason's alluded to. And therefore, leverage is going to be squeezed to a certain extent because of the lower dealership earning. So the prospective buyers just really need to be prepared to talk about their past successes, but also balance that with some realism and not pie in the sky numbers and what it looked like in more of a worst case scenario basis. I think sometimes they're challenged to think about what is a worst case scenario because everything's always come easy to them.
Good advice.
Well, changing gears a little bit. We've obviously done a lot of business with Live Oak Bank over the last number of years. In my mind, there's more to the story that Live Oak can offer besides just saying, hey, we're the SBA experts, which you clearly are and have been extremely helpful, certainly for our group. But what else do you bring to the table if you're talking to a listener or listeners listening in? What else would you tell them that you're an expert in or can help?
Yeah, I think the short answer is this is all we do. We aren't trying to refinance your floor plan. We aren't trying to sell you reinsurance product. We don't want your operating account. We don't want your treasury management product. Connor and I do one thing all day, every day, and that's talk to buyers. So whether we can put a deal together for you specifically or not, we're big believers in if we can help you do your deal, whether it's us finance or anybody else, that's good for the industry, that's good for us, that's good for everybody involved. So we oftentimes talk to 100 folks to find 10 or 20 deals that meets our needs. And for those 100 folks that we're talking to, we probably talk with them about 5, 7, 10 deals before one ultimately jumps off the page. And oh my gosh, this one just makes perfect sense for my family. So I would say if people ever just want to have a conversation about, what do you think I can afford? What should I be looking for? Who should I talk to? You should call Paul. You should call Jamie. Or maybe you shouldn't call this person because what they sell, you're not ready for yet. We love pointing folks in the right direction. We like helping them get one step closer to being able to get their deal done.
I mean, to say it the same, but a different way, we just really like to be a resource for folks. And I've mentioned it a couple of times now in the conversation, but we've been looped in earlier and earlier in the process to where folks probably aren't ready, right? Whether they don't have enough capital, don't have the experience yet, but we can put them in touch with the folks that will allow them to have a higher degree of success when they pursue that path to ownership. So I just like being a resource for folks. And yes, we can talk the ins and outs of the SBA loan product, but after 5 years, we've got a pretty good experience with most all of the manufacturers and a lot of the floor plan lenders to where we've got a pretty good understanding of what's going to work for them, what's not going to work for them. And so we can help answer some pretty important questions early on to add value so that they're not wasting time and effort and energy, given these deals take a lot of that and time to pull one together.
Just to piggyback on that, when you're working with a buyer, what's one thing, or buyers, what's one thing you wish that they understood better about the loan process that could make their lives a whole lot easier?
I would just take it one step further and just say, I wish prospective buyers understood how expensive dealerships are, right? It's a little bit ironic given we're talking about leverage and trying to get into the biggest store possible with the limited amount of capital, but dealerships are expensive. Multiples are coming down, but still are elevated based on historic levels. But even if you have the opportunity to come up with enough capital to buy a store, especially if it's one of these stores that has a profile that needs some TLC, increasing that market share is going to be expensive. You know, you're going to have to put money back into marketing, to new systems and processes, perhaps technology, because the dealer you bought the store from is 75 years old and really hasn't invested in modernizing the technology capabilities at the store. So it's just expensive, right? And so, yes, you want to help folks utilize the SBA product to get in there, but understand that it probably takes a little bit more than you think. So err on the side of conservatism when you're looking at stores to potentially buy, right? Everybody would love to buy a Toyota store in the metro market, but you're probably not going to be able to, right? So again, level setting your expectations on what's actually realistic for me. And then the other thing I would say, just based on experiences, are a lot of the prospects we speak with don't fully understand what unencumbered funds means. Obviously, there's a debt to equity requirement, whether that's 50% or 90%. You still have to come up with, you know, with the cash to buy a store. And, you know, we've talked with a lot of folks who, for example, have a lot of built up equity in real estate, but that doesn't actually equate to cash available for an acquisition, right? Or they come to us with, you know, a very minimal amount of cash. And based on the experiences that they've had, they've got a reinsurance company who's going to come up with a very ambitious warranty advance or production loan to bridge that gap. And hey, is that actually feasible to get you into a deal? So at some point, lenders, whether it's us, floor plan lender, manufacturer, they're going to inquire about your proof of funds. And that's happening earlier and earlier in the process, which means how much cash do you actually have proven by bank statements and brokerage accounts, et cetera, to actually get into a deal? So don't be surprised when that question comes up if you're listening on this podcast, that proof of funds is a real thing and it's unencumbered funds available to you. And be prepared to show that so that you can give everybody comfort that you actually have the ability to come up with the money to do the deal. And then I'll pass to Jason, but I mean, I hear it a lot and it can't be understated. Just being a prudent saver and living below your means is going to position you a heck of a lot better when you actually make that decision to buy a store. Again, we work with or talk with a lot of very, very successful general managers, maybe even minority partners in stores that have been super successful, but they want to keep up with this lifestyle, which becomes expensive. And then when time comes to actually buy a dealership, you know, hey, well, you've been making $500,000 to $1 million a year as a general manager. You only got $200,000 cash to buy a store. Like, where'd all that go, right? So I think if you're living below your means and are a prudent saver, you're going to give everybody a lot more comfort that, one, you are who you say you are, and you're actually going to be able to execute on the transaction when you get to the closing table.
Excellent advice.
I think it's really well said, Connor. I might go a little bit slightly different direction and add, I feel like every dealer that we talk to has an abundance of drive, energy, hard work, ethic, and they have been able to, Connor mentioned something early where, you know, these guys have only achieved success in their life and they've had roadblocks along the way, but hard work, putting in extra hours, working harder, trying harder has usually resulted in a win, right? And I think if you look at, especially like first-time buyers today, first-time buyer can be a GM, GSM, finance manager. They have acquired the skills over the duration of their career to where they feel abundantly confident that everything in the dealership they can do, right? So when they set out to then go buy a store, they have the earned confidence that they can do it. The one thing that they haven't done is buy a store. And I would just caution you to be prepared for you don't know what you don't know. And I'm going to start with a selfish and shameless plug of performance brokerage. You might have been a wonderful GM in a market area and think that you're going to pick up the phone as a buyer and just start soliciting sellers to potentially sell you the store. And we don't see that work well for very many people, right? Sellers want confidentiality. They don't want it getting into the marketplace that their store is for sale. And if they were to entertain a conversation, it usually isn't with a first-time buyer. We see more deals transact with a broker. Probably 80% of the first-time buyers that we have financed have come with a seller introduced via a broker, because the brokers do, and nobody does it. Performance does a wonderful job, better than anybody else, at putting together, you know, buyers and sellers and ensuring that the seller is motivated to sell and the buyer is qualified to buy it, right? Nobody wants to waste each other's time. And when you lock up one of these deals under an APA for an extended period of time, it's painful if the deal doesn't ultimately go through, right? So everything that's required to be a successful dealer. But when it comes to the buy-sell process, build a team around you of folks that can help you understand what you don't know. The broker is a great component. The lender is a great component. You need a great attorney. We lend in just about every industry you can think of, every franchise system that you can think of. When you think about the day of closing logistics and a buyer and seller penciling their deal, a automotive dealership is as complex as it comes. You sell cars to the moment the deal is transaction. And guess what? You're paying for the cars. So the attorney's ability to articulate, here's how we're going to value things up into the moment of closing. Here's how we're going to debate them, such that you don't get at the closing table all of a sudden over two or three cars that you can't get floored. And all of a sudden somebody has to come up with 150 grand of additional equity capital to buy cars that aren't floorable. A deal doesn't fall apart in the 11th hour. So it is okay to be not an expert in all things acquisition on your first acquisition, and would strongly encourage buyers. You've gotten everywhere you can through hard work and determination, but you might need a team to buy your first deal and your second and third. And would strongly encourage you to call out performance brokerage, because again, from the moment the deal gets introduced between buyer and seller and executed between buyer and seller, it's an inherent human trait to question, is this going to happen? Is this going to happen? And you really want to work with somebody that with both parties is going to be able to say, here's what you need to do. Here are the major milestones. Here's what the other person's got going on. And when there's a clear and concise expectation and it's being met along the way, you know, we just see deals go much more smoothly.
Yeah, I can't help but jump in and piggyback on it. A couple of things that we do at Performance that sometimes I think a buyer, especially a first-time buyer, feels we're a little harsh, but I'll be the first one. I mean, I've been at this a decade. And when I get a first-time buyer, I've had them out pretty hard. And quite frankly, I do it for the good of them. There are two things. I don't want to put them in front of a seller if I don't believe they're going to go through all the hoops that you know and we know they have to go through. It's not an easy process. And Connor, you mentioned a few minutes ago, it's not, you know, they need to know how expensive it is. Heck, my first store was a Chevrolet store. It was $200,000 unencumbered funds. That was it. And I was in running the deal. You can't do that today. It's impossible. The one thing I guess I would ask, because, you know, I have a pretty candid conversation. If I get on a call with a first-time buyer and I'll say, look, where are you willing to go? Where's your family? Where's your wife and your kids willing to go? Because the reality is, let's talk about how much cash you've got available. You're probably not getting a store in Kansas City. You probably got to go to Podunk, Kansas, or Iowa, or wherever it may be, and start out there and then build your dream. You want to get a dealer group, you got to start with one. Any advice that you would piggyback on that for a first-time buyer looking? Because I think they get, some that I've talked to kind of get hung up on where they want to be or how it's going to look like the perfect store. And sometimes it's not. It's like, it'll work, but it's maybe not perfect. Any thoughts on that?
I would strongly encourage folks to build their buy box before they start looking. I'm a big believer in once you start looking, something will naturally jump off the page and call to you. But this is going to be the most important financial decision of your life, number one. I think you need to be really disciplined on your buy box in the first one. And buy box is a very subjective term. Location is important, right? and location is multifaceted. You aren't going to move to a store and be successful if your family is not comfortable living in that market. And if it's your first store, you're probably not going to be able to afford to hire the type of person that you want to hire to manage your most important investment of your entire life should not be there, right? So can your family move there? What about, you know, you've built up a lifetime of people that you can call on to help you, right? And that's part of the benefit, right? You get there, you realize that, man, fixed operations is a challenge at this location. I need to call in a new fixed op manager or whatever key person. Can you convince the people that you trust to move to this market? What about brand, right? If there's certain brands that you can look back on your time leading up to this point of wanting to buy that you just weren't successful with, do you really want to stake your entire financial future on that brand? And I know it sounds silly to say making these decisions before you look, like you won't have the discipline while you're looking, but it comes very difficult because some things are going to jump off the page on a deal that make it very attractive. Like, oh my gosh, I never thought I could live in rural, pick a town, pick a brand. These are two things that were just a huge no for my family, but I can buy a 30% sales effective store at less than 1x earnings. And I think the financial upside is huge. But you get there, your family's miserable, you're commuting hundreds of miles away. The financial upside was based on being able to turn around, but you can't get anybody to move there to assist you. You got to find all new people. You burn through your operating capital in 6 months because you don't get this thing turned around. You would strongly encourage folks, build your buy box, stay disciplined, and then start looking across as many stores as humanly possible.
Great advice.
No, I mean, that was beautifully said.
I think we can wrap up if you guys are good with that. This has been awesome.
Fantastic.
I think Jason and I both suspect 25 to be active. Interest rates came down yesterday. They're probably going to come down a couple more times, which in theory should help financing and even the consumer level at the dealerships. But then obviously there's some post-election certainty now with the next administration hopefully being a little bit more pro-business, which I think is going to help dealers. But again, there are challenges, right? Normalization continues to occur. And like I said, leverage is probably going to come down to a certain extent because earnings are coming down, right? So honestly, I think Jason ended that beautifully with just being disciplined, right? I think these dealers get caught up in, you know, hey, their friend has been able to buy a store now, so they want to buy a store. And that's natural. And I think that a lot of folks should be able to buy stores, but it takes a lot of time. And inevitably, if you get into that store 4 or 5 years later, but it's the right opportunity, it probably puts you on a much better trajectory than settling for something less than because you can do it sooner. So I think the discipline part was just a wonderful note to end on.
All right. Wonderful. Connor and Jason, thank you so much. This had so much fantastic information in it. We really appreciate your time. And if dealers would like to get in touch with you, what would be the best way? Would it be the Live Oak Bank website, LinkedIn? You tell us.
Any and all the above. You can reach us directly at liveoakbank.com. Our email addresses and telephone numbers are there. Feel free to reach out on LinkedIn or call one of your friends at Performance Brokerage because most of them have our cell phone number. And I feel like oftentimes the easiest way to find us is when you start looking at deals and you find something that's interesting, please don't hesitate to call. The moment you're interested, we want to talk about cash flow, you, your store, your opportunity, and figure out how best to help.
Thanks, guys.
Okay. Really appreciate it. Thank you
very
much.
Take care. Bye-bye.
Thank you for joining us for this episode of Driving Performance. The show notes include links to any resources mentioned in today's show. If you're enjoying our podcast, please subscribe so you never miss an episode and leave us a 5-star review. If you're considering buying or selling an automotive dealership, reach out to us at performancebrokerageservices.com. or send an email to info@performancebrokerageservices.com.